Reset your system clock to 1993, start spamming those defensive laser shields, and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1, Amiga, Mac, and MS-DOS. Welcome back. I'm your host, Super VGA, and in today's episode, we're continuing our deep dive into another world for MS-DOS, the Amiga, and Windows 3.1. Oh boy, so as promised, I am recording these episodes concurrently. They couldn't actually be recorded concurrently. I just mean back to back. So that means that I know some of you, at least two of you, are listening to part one right now as I am recording part two, which means that probably in about an hour, or as long as this takes to record, I will have the second part of the Another World series ready for you to listen to. So yeah, that's a big content dump over one weekend, but I didn't want you to be without some good deep, we won't get into history, but some good deep info on Another World before I take a 1 week break it's not even taking a break. I take 1 week to write the third part of the episode, which is going to be purely on the history. So in this part of the episode, I'm going to be focusing on the game's content, its style, its story, its plot, the characters involved, etc., and some of the tech stuff. And then in the next episode, we're going to go real hard into the development history, as well as the kind of deep dive on the systems engineering. So for that reason, I'm going to forego my usual segments on the community memory, as well as, my inventory check, and we'll skip right into the content. So what is Another World? Another World, or Out of This World, is without a doubt, in my mind at least, the world's most ubiquitous cinematic platformer. While Prince of Persia is often cited as the cinematic platformer, Jordan Mechner himself pointed out in his diaries that it was in fact a theatrical platformer and not cinematic per se. Another World lives and breathes the language of cinema in its cutscenes, its rotoscoped creamy animations, and its almost completely silent film style of storytelling. While it shares a lot of visual similarities with Flashback, a game I talked about on a previous episode, the two are completely distinct, despite both coming from French developers actually in the same year. Another World has a very different interpretation of platforming than, say, Super Mario Brothers or even Prince of Persia. Yes, you can jump, and sometimes that involves jumping across chasms or hanging off of ledges, but the platforming in itself in Another World does not define the entire experience. Another World, in my opinion at least, far more comfortably fits into the adventure genre. Not a point-and-click game, but a game where you go on an adventure that requires you to explore your way through hazards and use your wits to get you through dangerous moments, past hurdles, past puzzles. If Super Mario Brothers is the first-person shooter of the platformer genre, this is, in my opinion, the Infocom think your way past enemies of the platformer genre. Why do I bother hanging on this point? Well, it's because so many of the scenes and puzzles in Another World are bespoke. That is, you generally don't reuse the same mechanics over and over, like running and jumping techniques that you learn how to master in Mario Brothers. For instance, thinking of Super Mario 3, when you learn how to fly with the raccoon sorry, with the raccoon suit. That's something you learn how to, you know, you hold down the run button. Eventually you build up enough speed on the speed meter, you hit a jump, and then you're able to coast and fly for a little bit. That's something you learn how to master over and over and over in the game. And then the rest of the game really opens up based on those mechanics. So the mechanic is actually critical to finishing the game. Another World's not like that. Each scene in Another World usually demands that the player takes advantage of the environment or the protagonist's tools in a different way each time. Now, there is some, you know, repeats, you know, for instance, Lester or Dr. Chaykin, Professor Chaykin, our main character, we'll talk about later, he jumps the same way. For instance, if you run and jump, he will jump exactly the same way each time. And yes, you will use that over and over and over throughout the game. However, the usefulness of those jumps changes according to the situation Lester is in. And I'll talk about that a little bit later on. You basically have to guess and test to learn what works in one scene might not work in the next scene, and that's purely due to a change in the environment or the tools the protagonist has on hand. Sometimes, for instance, the laser gun is great for shooting enemies in one room, but turns out to be useless as an offensive weapon in a different room. You'll see what I mean when I talk about the gameplay. It just feels different than other cinematic platformers. Flashback, Prince of Persia, Super Mario Brothers, they feel tight with kind of turn on a dime controls and snappy animations. Another World feels, I don't know, loose, painterly, gentle, maybe, in comparison. So let's talk grand story arc. The game opens up with Professor Lester Chaykin arriving at work in his new Ferrari on a dark and stormy night. Chaykin sits down to his computer and begins running a particle acceleration experiment to create antimatter. A freak lightning strike hits the particle accelerator, collides with the antimatter, and generates an explosion that leaves a gaping hole where Chaykin and his computer once stood, fade to black. Well, a few seconds later, Chaykin finds himself transported, to another world, where he'll have to use his wits and courage to survive and escape captivity from a hostile alien race. It's not a hugely complex or detailed story, but what stands out, and we'll talk about this in the style and implementation segment, the way in which Another World tells its story is very unique. The game is actually an exercise in gameplay and visual storytelling and doesn't rely upon words or dialogue to communicate the story arc. So let's talk system requirements. Well, this time it depends on what kind of computer you're running. If you want the original Chaï experience, it will be on the Amiga, specifically probably an Amiga 1000. Which required Kickstart 1.2. Don't worry, you Amiga 500 owners aren't left out, of course. It runs equally well, even on the slowest A500 using the ECS or OCS. That is, I think it's enhanced or original video chipsets. This means that if you're in an NTSC region like North America, you'll be playing Another World at 320 by 200 at 60 hertz. If you're in a PAL region like Europe, you're going to be playing 320 by 256. I always forget that the horizontal and vertical? I think it's the vertical number of vertical scan lines increases. Sorry. So yes, 320 by 256 at 50 hertz for PAL. So slightly slower, but don't worry, that actually has, that's almost meaningless for Another World because the in-game frame rates are actually a lot slower than 50 or 60 hertz. You're never going to come close to that with Another World. Unbelievably, it only uses 16 colors of the Amiga's 32 or 64, depending on the chipset you've got on your Amiga, available on-screen colors. We'll get to that in the tech section because that's actually an incredibly important part of the story of what makes this game so special. Now, if you're in MS-DOS and want to run the original floppy disk version, you're going to need an 8286 with 512 kilobytes of RAM, and it'll at least have to be running MS-DOS 2.1. Those are amazingly low specs for a game released in 1992 and 93. I'm saying 92 and 93 because the original game was released in 92 on the Amiga, and then it took them about, 6 months to a year to port it over to MS-DOS for distribution through Interplay. The original Amiga version was published by Delphine, I believe, in 92. 93 got the MS-DOS version. Now, keep in mind that as one of our listeners, Edgar, wrote in the previous episode, some folks were already running a 486 SX25 with 4 megs of RAM in 1992 and 93. That is, a full 2.5 generations ahead of where you needed to be in order just to play the game. In fact, when I bought this game, as I mentioned in the previous episode, my Amstrad PC was only an XT class machine squeezing out a paltry 8 megahertz. Now, Another World didn't run well. I got slow motion movement. The game had no frame skipping built in of any kind. So actually, when Lester runs down the screen, he was actually running in slow motion. I was getting about 50% of the intended speed. So for the first year, I thought he was supposed to run at that speed. I thought this was just, I don't know what to call it, an intended cinematic effect. That is until I tried it on my friend's 486 DX33, and I was shocked at just how hard that game was at a full 60 frames per second. If you're on a Tandy 1000, the game does support the Tandy's TGA video chipset. That's the Tandy graphic adapter. But the manual cautions you that you require a full 640K of RAM for that. This wouldn't be notable, except for the fact of why you need 640K on the Tandy version versus 512 on the MS-DOS IBM PC version. That's because, for instance, on my Tandy 1000 TL2, which is sitting right beside me here, it actually steals 128K away from the conventional memory to use as VRAM. So you actually end up only with 512 kilobytes of usable conventional memory after you boot. So the solution is on the Tandy 1000, you actually get a little, RAM you're going to be upgrading. So you get a video RAM chip upgrade. So it's no longer stealing RAM from the, I hope I got that right. So don't quote me on that. I believe it's the VRAM you're upgrading. So it's not stealing any more shared memory from the conventional RAM. Anyway, that's something to keep in mind. Now, interestingly enough, there is a CD-ROM edition that came out years later. It requires a 386 SX16 with 4 megs of RAM and MS-DOS 5.0, and it supports both MS-DOS and, get this, Windows 3.1. Despite it looking like just another CD shovelware release from Interplay, it is actually different, and it contains a native coded Windows 3.1 port of the game. Hard to believe. I'll talk about this in the port segment towards the next episode of this podcast, not this one, but it is a super neat rarity. I've never actually found a copy for myself. I do intend on buying it because I have played it. It showed up on Home of the Underdogs or some other site a few years ago after being lost for a long, long time. If I remember correctly, it was actually ported by the same coders who went on to producing IL2 Sturmovik, if I could take a guess at that name. That's a Russian group. That's just off the top of my head. I believe this is one of their first projects. They started off porting stuff. So anyway, pretty amazing that there is an actual Windows 3.1 version, and I'll talk about that a bit later. So let's talk style and implementation. The game's introduction opens up with that aforementioned dark, stormy night A side view of a building in an industrial area on the outskirts of town. The wind blows, kind of carries dust and leaves and trash across the street as a black silhouette. The black Ferrari slides into view, screeches its tires to a stop. This tall, lanky figure steps out of the car. The camera cuts down to a really, really low angle shot, zoomed in super, super close to a shot of canvas shoes walking up to a door. Right from the get-go, the presentation is purely using the language of cinema. And I don't mean cinema-like. I mean these are actual camera shots and film-style editing, and they're meant to look that way specifically for dramatic effect. Now, this may seem like a small point to make. After all, the world has already labeled it a cinematic platformer, and we all know this. But think back to the early 1990s. The words cinematic platformer didn't exist. We didn't use that language in 1990. Just calling something a platformer, period, was not part of our common lingo in video games. I took a brief look at the marketing Interplay and Sega used, as well as the original box cover art, and nowhere is the word platformer found. So in a sense, by looking back on this game, we're introducing language for understanding the game that is not native to the period the game lived in. Why does that matter? Well, because ultimately, when we're doing game history, half of the job involves understanding the mechanics and presentation of the game itself. But the other half, and it's equally important, involves understanding how people themselves thought about those games in that time. So it's a balanced job I'm trying to do, is both understanding the game itself on its own terms and understanding the game on the terms of the people who played it at that time. I am not trying to introduce as best I can an external framework from which to understand the game based in 2022. That's not a great idea, and it's not a good way of doing history. So what did people make of Another World back in the day? Well, Interplay's box art advertises it as bridging the gap between cinema and action-adventure games because it generates real-time rotoscoped animation in a fluid system of cinematic zooms, pans, close-ups, and scaling, the same cutting-edge technology that lies at the heart of today's best flight simulators. So, marketing was obviously really hung up on the cinematic aspect. After all, this actually wasn't a solved problem in the computer gaming world of 1990. Everyone in the 90s saw cinema as that kind of peak, unreachable goal of computer gaming. Now, naturally, as graphical and audio fidelity improved over the years, the prospect of full motion video became actually realizable in the mid-90s. But this was quite a bit earlier in terms of computer time. This was 1991 and 92, and FMVs were, at best, postage stamp affairs that ran at 5 to 10 frames per second on a single speed CD-ROM. Another World, on the other hand, pulled off 15 frames per second on a 286 on two floppy disks, pulling off something the press could call cinematic from such meager horsepower was an amazing feat of engineering at the time. And we'll talk about just how Another World pulled all of that off technically in the software engineering segment of the podcast. Now, I'll spare you a shot-by-shot rundown of the introduction. Suffice to say, the protagonist, after a terrible explosion at his particle accelerator, this professor of physics, Dr. Chaikin, vanishes completely. The game begins completely in medias res. That is, the particle experiment explosion teleports Chaikin to the middle of a lake, where he is 20 feet underwater. The transition from the introduction to gameplay is so seamless that if you were anything like me when you first played it, you had no idea you were actually supposed to be in control of the game. I watched Chaikin drown a few times before I realized that the game expected me to take the reins. One of the most surprising and noticeably different parts of this experience are that right off the bat, I noticed that there's no HUD. There's no familiar heads-up display, top score, extra lives, health bar, or any kind of metadata about the game or the character on the screen. It's just, you know, Professor Chaykin at his computer desk, all sinking together towards the bottom of a lake. You have no idea what you're supposed to do, and there are no tutorials or on-screen indicators to suggest where to go. Suddenly, out of the bottom, tentacles rise from the bottom of the screen towards Chaykin. Naturally, you press the up arrow to escape them. He feebly swims upwards towards the unknown, and seconds later pops out of the surface of the water with a little petite splash. What now? Well, pressing up doesn't do anything else for a few seconds. Chaykin crawls onto the shoreline like a drenched animal and stands around there. If you stick around too long, the tentacles kind of come up out of the lake, wrap around his ankles, and pull him down to a watery grave. So, after watching this happen a couple of times, you hit left and right and he starts walking around. So, what's happening is the game is teaching you, by virtue of trying and dying a whole lot, to experiment constantly with the controls. The manual gives you the bare minimum of instructions on how the control keys are used, and it's obvious that you're going to be expected to do all the mental heavy lifting. This is going to be a sticking point for some people. We'll talk about that later in the Not So Surprises segment of the show. In the first few screens of the game, you're going to fight for every foot of progress you make. There are death traps around every corner, from the lake tentacle in the water to poisonous crawling ground leeches to a big mean shadow beast that's going to chase you down. Progression through the game is screen by screen, and the screens do not scroll horizontally or vertically. So in that way, it actually shares a lot more with Prince of Persia and Flashback than it does Super Mario Brothers. There are moments, too, where you need to be at a full tilt run in one screen so you can make a jump early on the adjacent screen without seeing it coming up. So getting to know the lay of the land and planning ahead for big jumps is actually half of the battle. Now, another thing I've noticed is that the game is surprisingly silent. There are no musical accompaniments throughout the game, no background music, no soundtrack, no MIDI in DOS, no mod in the Amiga version. All of the emotional context comes from the animation and sound effects. You'd imagine for a more cinematic quote-unquote experience, Shai would have went with background music. There is probably a technical reason for the game not having background music. And I'm setting aside the wonderful intro music and endgame music by Freitas. I think his name might be Freitas. But yeah, don't quote me on that. I imagine it's Freitas. But I think there's actually another equally valid consideration owing to Another World's influences of why it doesn't have background music. It was partly influenced by the comic books Shai was reading in his time. He specifically mentions Dragon Ball Z as one of his influences for the Super Laser Shot, which I'll talk about in a little bit. So it's not unimaginable that he's already thinking in terms of comic books while he's making the game. I'm not a huge comic book reader, but you know, in terms of my understanding of how comic books are read and experienced by comic book readers, they're full of, you know, when Batman has a fight, you see like biff, pow, etc. And it's, you know, very explosive text in the panel. And it's expected that you imagine the sound effects as Batman's beating up some baddie. Well, nowhere in my limited experiences with comic books are there moments where it says, you know, cue background music. Imagine, I don't know, Ave Maria in this scene. No, that's not really a part of how comic books are read and understood. So I imagine that in terms of the way Shai designed the game, it was very intentional. And because of that, the silence stands out and actually lends atmosphere to the action rather than detracting from it. So think about that. Silence adding atmosphere to a game. And that's probably because of the contrast there. You've got a silent world where you're forced to focus on the sound effects and the animation to understand the emotional context of what you're seeing. The animation itself is something I haven't seen before and since Another World. Yes, it's rotoscoped, insofar as certain cutscenes like the Ferrari screeching into the parking lot were rotoscoped from a little black toy car he had, Shai had, or Chicken's hand picking up the black laser pistol. That little animation was Shai's hand picking up a toy gun fabricated out of cardboard. Those are obvious moments for rotoscoped animation, and they're very beautiful, but what stands out more to me are the character animations. These ones don't appear to be rotoscoped. They have a different kind of fluidity than heavy gravity-fearing human beings have when we run. Chicken almost floats in the air when he's running, and especially when he jumps. It's such an exaggerated jump. His swimming animation is more like a caricature of swimming than the way a real human being swims. The most obvious moment to me is when Chaikin uses one of the teleport gaps later in the game, and I'll try to talk about that a bit later on, where he actually disintegrates in midair, zooms downward as a bunch of kind of stretched vertical lines, and then reintegrates on the other end of the teleporter. It's an incredible bit of animation. It adds so much dynamism to the scene, and it's not something that you would get from rotoscoped animation from film, because there's no reference to rotoscope this from. He imagined this, and it's something that you would definitely would have seen in a comic book, but not in a film. So the animation, in my opinion, is soft, it's painterly, and it's breathtaking. It has none of the hard edges to it that characterizes movement in Flashback, and I'm talking about the character animation specifically. Flashback, in contrast, is extremely tight, it's kind of angular and photographic in its animation cycles, its character walk cycles, for instance. Flashback looks, feels like a series of photographs animated into a bitmap sequence, which is exactly what it is. Another World, on the other hand, uses a very different method for animating characters that, while probably rotoscoped to some degree, I'm imagining that he probably did use some sort of visual reference to rotoscope on Chicken's run animation. Nonetheless, it is poly-based, and it leads to much more fluid, softer animation style, and we're going to talk about the difference between polygon and bitmapped rotoscoping a bit later on in the software engineering segment. Now, going back to sound, the game relies a lot upon environmental sounds to lend atmosphere to each scene. You'll really notice it in the Amiga version, which takes advantage of stereo audio channels, and these are profitably used to cue the player towards the action on screen. And that's something I think I'll just let you listen to a few seconds of that right now. Those little ticks in the background you're hearing are actually the slave miners swinging their pickaxes into the rocks. On the right side, you're hearing a guard yelling at you, firing his pistol up into the air to kind of scare you. And I think that was the sound of the swinging... Of course, the classic line from your best friend. All I'm trying to point out there is that the game actually did a great job of using the right and left stereo channels in order to communicate the on-screen action. This is something, unfortunately, you will be deprived of in the MS-DOS version because it is actually using the monaural speaker. Even if you are using a sound blaster, it is not going to be in stereo. Now, in terms of progression through the game, one thing I hadn't thought about too much, but I noticed it certainly on my latest playthrough a couple of days ago, contrasting with Super Mario Brothers, for instance, and more comparing favorably with a game like Metroid, progression is both left to right, right to left, as well as top to bottom and bottom to top, depending on the kind of environment you're in. Chaikin will need to swim up and out of a lake or down into the depths of a flooded cavern. Sometimes he starts on the right side of an area, needs to move leftward to, I don't know, hit some sort of switch, and then moves back to that right side same area to double back and exit through a new doorway that's opened up because he hit the switch on the left side. The game is built around a world as opposed to a series of distinct levels which kind of have a theme, and I would say that's more of a Mario Brothers style approach. Now, one big aspect conspicuously absent from the game as far as adventure gamers or film goers might have noticed is that Another World has absolutely no dialogue. You won't find yourself chatting your way out of a prison cell with the guard or making friends with an alien by sharing war stories with him in your prison cell. The only words you'll ever hear are the guard barking, which you heard, "Wachinga, Wachinga," and your best friend. I've never actually been able to understand what his name is. Is it Matsuba? I think there are so many different ways of interpreting the way that it's said. I've heard it many, many different ways from different people. Those are the only words you really hear. Every bit of the story in the game is communicated via animated character gestures. That's your best friend kind of waving it to you like, come this way, come this way. Facial expressions in a cutscene. There's this little part at the start of the game where Chaikin wants to show that he's basically not a threat to these alien guards. So he puts up his hand and kind of, single show of friendship and his little smirk. You see a little smirk out of the corner of his face. That earns him a laser shot to the guts. It's just different. Of all of the things I've described so far, I think this sets Another World apart more from any other game in its genre. The only kind of comparison I can make is with Prince of Persia, insofar as Prince of Persia tends to mime out its story through animated sequences, and there are not a lot of them in Prince of Persia, just a few. But again, Prince of Persia is more of a theatrical game than a cinematic one. Towards the end of Another World, you'll find that Shahi delivers a ton of emotion from the final scenes of the game with some delicately choreographed fighting and animation sequences down to the final endgame sequence cinematic, all without saying a world. Without saying a world. You play your way through this story. You don't watch it happen or listen as it's told to you. So with that kind of general overview of what the game is like, let's talk nice surprises. Save points. It has save points without manual saves. This is probably a pretty divisive issue, but I think it discourages the player from saving every 5 feet and instead encourages the player to just try everything, and you're going to die, but you're only going to be reset maybe 30 seconds before you tried last time. I think this is way ahead of its time, considering that almost all adventure games coming out at the same time as this game were based on manual saves, and platformers were based on full level saves. The controls in the game are surprisingly straightforward. Up, down, left, right arrow keys and the space bar. It was really meant to be played on a joystick, and it's still pretty enjoyable on a keyboard, which I think is to its credit. Controls are context sensitive and constantly changing according to the character's position and disposition on screen. What he's got in his hands, what's happening around him in the environment. When you've got the gun, pressing spacebar flips it up, his arm up into firing position. Hitting the spacebar again cracks off a single shot. Holding down the spacebar, and this is what makes the control so enjoyable for players like me who love to experiment and explore, creates the infamous building up kind of power laser shot that can either turn into a defensive wall, the defensive shield, or this big ball blast of a super laser shot. In another scene, Chaikin's trapped inside of an alien tank, and you suddenly take control of his hand. And now, in this case, pressing space actually punches a button in front of his fingertip, and you have to punch in the right sequence of buttons to escape from the scene. Every time the controls change, they somehow feel entirely fair once you've learned what they are. But there is going to be that frustration moment or frustration hour when you're trying to just figure out what is the context of the situation such that I have to work with the controls differently in this scene. Now, that being said, this isn't Super Mario Brothers where A is jump, B is run at all times in all situations. I think that there, I'm not trying to be an editorialist about this, but both have their pluses. Super Mario Brothers is extremely predictable and playable for that reason. A is run, B is jump, or whatever, whichever one it is. I think it's that one. This because the controls context changes according to Chaikin's situation. For I think console gamers especially, this probably was a pretty rude awakening in its time. Another thing I really liked about this game is that there are no dead ends. Well, sort of. Okay, so this is really surprising in an early action-adventure game, and I'm surprised that no one else has mentioned this in their reviews. It appears that Shahi thought ahead and will not let you restart the game after you've made a decision that will prevent you from finishing the game. The game will always restart you before you caused a Walking Dead scenario. Somebody else called this soft lock recently. I thought that was also a great way of putting it. First time I've heard that term. So you can go back and correct the mistake you made. Here I'm specifically thinking of a scene where you need to disable a pacing guard below you by dropping something on his head. If you miss the guard with the object, you will survive the scene. However, you won't be able to get past him and he'll kill you every time. So when he kills you, it actually rewinds you to the moment before you had the chance to drop something on his head. It's almost like a subtle cue that, hey, you know what? Now, I didn't notice this when I was 13 years old. I noticed this much later on that the game is actually trying to teach you how to play it and finish it. So, yes, technically you are in a Walking Dead scenario after you've missed the guard with the falling object. And it smashes beside him instead of on his head. Yes, there are 30 seconds of Walking Dead scenario where you have to try to run past the guard and he'll kill you every time. But that's a pretty small price to pay compared to, I don't know, Police Quest 2 or one of the Leisure Suit Larrys. I think, I can't remember which one. King's Quest 5. Eat the pie, and find out later in the game you really needed that pie to take out a Yeti. Crazy stuff. Okay, that's not to say this game is perfect. In fact, I would say this is probably, for a lot of people, one of the most imperfect games ever made, but all the more reason for me to love it. Not so nice surprises. So, this game has a Dragon's Lair-like control system. Some people probably wanted a walkthrough from the very beginning with this game. One of the funniest things I've ever seen is watching Shahi himself play the game through live at some sort of gamer event in the US in front of an audience and laughing his ass off as he can't get past his own jumping puzzles. I think the one I'm thinking of specifically is the part where you're jumping across these, I call them chompers. They're basically just these teeth in the ground that as soon as you get close to them, they start like opening and closing like a little death trap. And if he gets his leg caught in there, he eats his leg alive. Shai's trying to jump across this little chasm with the chompers underneath, and he can't do it. And at first he chuckles, and he's like, oh yeah, okay, I'll try it again. Second time, he's like, ah, ha, 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 yeah, I got caught again. Third time, he's like, okay, this is hard. Fourth time, he's like, gets really silent. The crowd is laughing their butts off. I think it takes him 5 or 6 tries to finally do it. And everyone claps when he finally gets across, and you realize, yeah, this is a hard game. In some ways, Dragon's Lair is actually somewhat fairer to the player. That is, if you pay attention to the flashing light on screen hints that tell you where to go and what to do. And it encourages you how to memorize moves. In another world, memorizing moves will sort of help. It's more like memorizing rhythm because you need to get the character's jumps lined up in exactly the right pixel perfect precision to make it across one chasm and then dive into a roll so you can make it underneath another thing before it crushes you or you get chomped to death from something underneath your feet. The game is absolutely unforgivable at those moments, and I guarantee this caused more than a few hundred thousand people to pull out their hair in frustration. On that subject, the constant deaths and rewinds to an earlier invisible save point are a bit of an issue. What do I mean by earlier invisible save point? Well, at certain points, the game will automatically remember that you've passed an invisible barrier, and when you die, you'll restart at that earlier point instead of starting at the very beginning of that quote-unquote level, even though this game doesn't have levels. Now, sometimes this is fine because the invisible save point was only a few screens earlier. So, for instance, when you're trying to drop something on the guard's head, you've only really lost 30 seconds of progress before you can try again. But in other parts of the game, when you get to the end of a full segment or level of the area, and again, this is not a levels-based game. I'm just using that as a way of describing, a 5 to 10 minute, well, let's not say 5 minute, a 3 to 5 minute segment. Oh man, is it awful when you restart 5 minutes earlier. A lot happens in this game in 5 minutes. And you will lose your life and have to rewind 5 minutes at a few points. And now, excuse me for a second. I'm starting to lose my voice. That's what 2 hours of podcasting today do. I assume this is actually very different according to the different ports. For instance, the Super NES port of this game is fantabulous. Excellent port of the game. And for some reason, I remember it being slightly easier, actually, than the MS-DOS version, because I think the invisible save points are a lot closer together. This is one thing I did not test out, but I probably should before I get to the port segment of this podcast, so I can tell you about how the different ports actually treat things like saving. Unfortunately, one of the weaknesses of the game is that it's actually pretty short. I would say of everything I've mentioned so far, this is one of my personal big peeves with the game. It will be understandable why you can actually finish the game in under 15 minutes if you've got the dexterity and the actions memorized and you've got a good sense of rhythm. But you do feel a bit robbed once you finish the game once and you realize, whoa, that was not a tremendous amount of content compared to, for instance, Flashback, which I want to say Flashback is a short game too, but it's at least a 3 to 4 hour commitment. It's no Super Mario Brothers, I'll put it that much, with its 55 odd levels. Another weakness, I don't know, that people will probably point out is the password system. It works, but the invisible save points are not included in your password save, as far as I know, in the MS-DOS version. Again, this is one of those things. I don't know if this is true for every single version of the game. However, when you get a password prompt from every time you die, you will get a password prompt saying, oh, your current password is FGAD. And then if you type that in, it'll rewind you to the most recent invisible save point on that level. That is probably different according to each port, because again, companies like Nintendo get really antsy about being fair to the player, and they playtest like crazy at Nintendo, so they probably forced Shai's team to introduce more save points to make the game more playable. I'm not sure, but the password system is a bit of a pain point, even though back in its time, it was actually a fantastic industry standard, basically. Flashback in Blackthorn, by the way, there's a game I forgot to mention, Blackthorn, Blizzard's Blackthorn. If you're not familiar with Blackthorn, Blackthorn is Blizzard's answer to Flashback and Another World. I think it's a totally valuable game in its own right, but I'm not going to talk about it this time. It has a much worse save system than Another World. It sends you back to the start of the level every single time, and boy, does it hurt. Overall, now keep in mind, I can't rewind back in time and remember what the game was like for me the first time I played it. I remember it being very punishing, but I thought it was probably fair. It definitely was not fair. It's not a fair game. However, looking back at it, the overall quality of the game is so high that its weaknesses seem to kind of overcome, are overcome by its quality in every respect. I hate to leave an episode hanging on this note, but I think this is a good cutting point. I've gotten through the meat and potatoes of what Another World is and how you move your way through the world, and what the pain points are, what the wonderful, unique points are. So we'll save the nitty-gritty of the game's development history, its software engineering, and its many ports for the next episode, which I haven't even written. It's going to take me a good 5 to 7 days to write it. So we're going to go with this more weekly system for releasing episodes. Not once a week, I'm saying more weekly, probably every 10 days, because that gives me enough time to write it. My goal in these episodes, as I alluded to in the last episode, is to actually do about 45 minutes to 1 hour of research per day at most. And that gives me 5 hours of research every 5 days, which is not a huge amount, but it's enough. Meaning, maybe after 10 days, I will have enough research to have written an entire episode and be able to record it. Now, that means that all of the episodes will become multi-part, just because of the way that the writing system works. You know, I've broken it up into segments. But it also means that you guys will get episodes way sooner, probably 2 a month, if my writing system works the way it's working today. And that way, you will not be waiting 11 months for the next episode where I can string 5 days together in a row of free time. So I'm looking forward to trying out this new writing and research system. I'm hoping that this podcast is still good. I don't know. I'm out of practice. You guys will have to tell me. I don't need your feedback. I'm just saying that if it's not good, please tell me. Or if it's getting boring or something, or if I've changed the format so much you hardly recognize it. But I hope this has brought back some happy memories. In the next episode, as I mentioned before, I will be talking development history, software engineering, and the ports, as well as where to get it. And there is so much in each of these parts that I may even have parts 3 and 4 of this. I suspect part 3 will be development history only, and part 4 will be software engineering, because I found the world's greatest resource. It's practically a game engine black book on Another World, so I can get into the real nitty-gritty, deep in the weediest, nastiest part of the marsh, understanding of how Another World's engine works. So it's going to be, don't panic, it's going to be only 10 days, but it'll be 7 to 10 days before the next episode, and we will talk development history. So this is your friend Super VGA signing off. And in the next episode, I do have 1 or 2 letters to read out, and I will do that in the next episode, just not this one. So checking my watch here, I noticed that it is going to be May the 8th tomorrow in North America, meaning it is probably May the 8th already in Australia and some other zones. So if you're a mom, happy Mother's Day. And if you have a mom, wish her a happy Mother's Day. And if your mom is dearly departed, please think of her and have some happy memories of being with her. So this is your friend Super VGA signing off, and I'm going to be spending Mother's Day tomorrow with my mother-in-law and my own mom, and I will be celebrating probably outside because it's absolutely gorgeous. You folks have a wonderful weekend. Talk soon. Finally, a personal note to listeners. When I recorded the first episode of this podcast way back in 2018, I was starting to write a book about growing up with computers of the 80s and 90s, modems, bulletin board systems, and even the early internet. It took several years to write it all down, but I managed to weave together over 80 of those stories, many of which I allude to in this podcast, into a novel-length book. It's called Mages and Modems: A Childhood Well Wasted in the Golden Age of Personal Computers, Games, and Internet Piracy. The stories are heartwarming, funny, and honestly, sometimes a little embarrassing. I don't ask for donations to keep this podcast running, so if you'd like to support me and see new episodes of the podcast, please head on over to my website at tomotama.com/books. That's tomotama.com/books, and order a copy of Mages and Modems. There you'll find a DRM-free ebook edition and a beautifully printed paperback edition that I actually designed myself. I hope the stories bring back for you some of the warm memories of the DOS, Windows, and Macintosh era that we all love.